way to reach us, friends, info@irishradio.com. And now we are going to cross over to Ireland and to Quentin Oliver. He is an associate of Strategem, and he's a former business owner prior to, indeed, to his merger with Connect. Quentin led the Yes campaign for the Good Friday Agreement referendum in 1998 before developing Strategem's creative initiatives to serve organizations' objectives, growing the company, enhancing its reputation, indeed, on the cutting edge of public policy, strategic communications, training, and campaign skills. He's also the founder and chair of the Consultation Institute in Northern Ireland and advisor to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation. You know, first of all, you're very welcome, Quentin.
Thank you, Adrian. Good to talk to you. And good afternoon from Ireland.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, we have been somewhat reluctant to, on a weekly basis, go back and forth with respect to predictions as to whether or not British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will leave Northern Ireland high and dry and, you know, fulfill his commitment to having Brexit done and dusted by Halloween. Rarely, Quentin, do we have the opportunity to say, well, it's looking good, or it seems like if negativity, if there was a prize for negativity in the last couple of months, it would go indeed to you know, those of us in Irish America who are, you know, we have enough of our own troubles over here, thank, you know, please God, they won't get any worse. But there is a change as we, you know, as we move towards the deadline. You know, as always, we look towards you as a conflict resolution analyst for what has always been a very significant analysis of what's going on. What's different about this weekend?
Well, it's very interesting, and I like the phrase, when people get worried and depressed that nothing seems to be positive, it's always darkest before the dawn, because that summarizes the high-level negotiations that are taking place. And, of course, negotiations between any two organizations, far less the 27 members of the European Union and the British and the Irish, and within Northern Ireland, all the different groupings here, of course negotiations are going to be controversial, and they're not going to go smoothly. And we can roll our eyes and say they've had 3 years, but it's only now that they're getting serious. And that reminds me of the negotiations leading up to the Good Friday Belfast Agreement in 1998. Remember, it took 2 years of talk, 2 years of intense talks, and it took George Mitchell, Senator Mitchell, who was sent by President Clinton to be his envoy and who chaired the talks, to set that deadline. You know, he said, look, I'm having a child back in the States. I want out by Easter. And they suddenly got serious. And I can remember those last 2 weeks of ups and downs. Remember that time when John Taylor, deputy leader of the Ulster Unionists, now Lord Kilcrooney, when he stormed out of the talks on the Monday of Good Friday, so just 4 days before Good Friday, and said he wouldn't touch the latest draft on the table with a 40-foot pole. And it seemed as if the talks were collapsing. But that was a negotiating tactic, showing that they were getting serious. and then 4 days later they came through with the agreement. So I think that's the situation that Boris Johnson and Leo Varadkar set up with their summit in Liverpool earlier this week, that neither serious, neither trading real negotiating tactics, and now the next few days we'll see whether they can do the deal.
In very early in your career, you led the yes vote for the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. And, you know, perhaps we ought to go back that 31 years to what history will record were all of these negotiations that were taking place, the highs, the lows. But I'd like you to bring us back to, you know, the groundswell, if there was one, with respect to, you know, the establishment of the Good Friday Agreement, Belfast Agreement. And how did the island of Ireland, and in particular Northern Ireland, influence the resulting agreement, which indeed historically would you know, stand out in history as the first time home rule came to Northern Ireland?
Well, that was a set piece negotiation of textbook characteristics, where the two governments, the UK government and the Irish government, were holding the ring, where Senator Mitchell was the independent external facilitator who was nudging people along and doing shuttle diplomacy between the different parties. Remember, at that time, the Unionists and Sinn Féin wouldn't sit in the same room together. Yeah. So there was proxy talks and shuttle diplomacy over those 2 years with the 10 Northern Ireland parties that had been elected into the process. So that gave them a mandate through an election into the process. And then two parties withdrew. You remember Ian Paisley's DUP and Robert McCartney's smaller UK Unionist Party. They withdrew as Sinn Féin entered. And then the hard graft of working out what were the North-South arrangements on the island, what were the east-west arrangements between the two islands, what were the internal structures, the power sharing, the principle of consent that would set the platform for Northern Ireland's governance. So that framework was a model, a textbook model of how a comprehensive peace agreement can be reached. And in as much as it was bottom-up by the Northern Ireland parties, and I was working in the non-profit sector, so we were putting in our requests as well from the outside, as were the business organizations, or unions, what we call civil society. So that created an agreement that had a lot of support that was proven in the referendum when 71% of people in the North voted for it and 94% in the South. And that gave it a legitimacy for the next couple of decades. Now, we haven't implemented it all, and we're stuck at the moment. That is, ironically, largely because of Brexit, because that has divided us again. It's taken us back to the prospect of a border with border crossings, with smuggling, with tariffs, with taxes, with long waiting times and searches and so forth. And that's why we're now in a difficult place. We haven't returned to huge violence. There still is some violence. And that journalist, Lira McKee, was a friend of mine who was killed in Londonderry a few months ago, reminds us that violence is not gone. But we have set a better course, and that's why we need to solve this Brexit problem so we can get back to working within Northern Ireland to bring our two communities and all the incoming communities and others together and across the island.
You know, my guest friends, Quentin Oliver, a conflict resolution specialist, and indeed, Quentin, you continue to travel around the world wherever conflict has taken, mostly on the political level. I want to though address head on what many of us on this side of the Atlantic are almost embarrassed to bring up. Tomorrow is the 1,000th day, of the Assembly in Northern Ireland without any political leaders. There are many who would say, "Wait a minute, you mean for 800 years what Ireland really wanted was, home rule?" And somehow, going back to the Good Friday Belfast Agreement, now they got it. Now they have an assembly in Northern Ireland. Theoretically, at least, anyway, that kind of brought political decisions, economic decisions, everything right into the six counties of Northern Ireland. And you couldn't blame people for saying, "Wait a minute, so you mean for the last 1,000 days there is no assembly in Northern Ireland? There is no local government in Northern Ireland? And how is that, how do you perceive that in terms of now the last shuffle, as it were, to try to put Brexit in order, considering that there's nobody running the ship up there?"
Indeed, and of course, it's less than ideal that we have hit this gridlock, this state of chassis, as the playwright might have said. It is not a good situation to be in, and Brexit has caused those divisions. The interesting difference, Adrian, is this. In the past, where you have, say, roughly a third of Northern voters backing the DUP and being strong unionists with the UK, and a third roughly backing Republicans and wanting a united Ireland. Now, the middle third are the interesting ones, because in the past they were assumed to be soft unionists. So if there were a border poll, they would vote to stay in the UK, because they like the National Health Service, they like the BBC, they like the British Army, they like the rule of law in Britain and all the stability that it gave. Now that's changing. And there's push and pull factors there, because now Britain doesn't look stable. It doesn't look progressive. It looks really rather harsh. It looks incompetent at parliamentary level, with the Prime Minister being taken to task by the Supreme Court and put back in his place. It hasn't run the NHS well, and people are worried about their health care. The British Army is under serious investigations in certain matters. So they are less attracted to the UK, and then they look south, and they see a modern European economy, a secular state that has separated church and state, that has dealt with the problems of the past, that has voted for equal marriage, that has voted to change the constitutional ban on abortion, and that has 7% economic growth. And suddenly, that middle third in the north are beginning to say, "Well, where does our best future lie? And might it be in a Europe with Ireland and 500 million consumers in that market, while the UK seems to be looking inward, looking backward, little empire, little past, and isn't quite so attractive?" So that debate is shifting significantly, and the next month, in terms of what happens to Brexit, right, will fuel that debate.
But again, I don't want to beat this into the ground as I continue to play devil's advocate, and that is, how is it helpful? How is it even possible that 1,000 days down the road there is no representation, there is no assembly in Northern Ireland to actually address this? You've implied that all of this was, pretty much caused by Brexit. But before Brexit, how did Northern Ireland operate? You've underlined all of the advantages of having, you know, local government, an assembly that had to make a case for, you know, to break it down into brass tacks, funding, all of the benefits that the UK indeed affords to, you know, to all of their citizens. How did that come about? I mean, there are many that say, well, you know, Martin McGuinness was indeed, he was responsible for, you know, the collapse of the Northern Ireland Assembly. On the other hand, of course, there are many who say that you know, the on the unionist side, they just dug their heels in, and equal blame, if not more blame, should go to them. Give us a picture of that particular you know, breakdown, and why it hasn't gotten off the ground since.
Yes. Now, the breakdown was a mixture of things, as always. There was exits had just happened in the June before of 2016, so that had sent shockwaves between unionism and nationalism as they were facing in different directions. There was also the heating scheme scandal that is about to report, the judgment inquiry is about to report on that, possibly in the next month, just to add to the excitement of the next month, on who was at fault there, and was there small c corruption or capital C corruption, and will there be references to the police and the prosecutory services on that one, plus an Irish language dispute where the DUP had stopped a small Irish language grant that broke the straw that broke the camel's back of a lot of nationalists who felt this was so seriously unfair. So these things swirling around caused Sinn Féin and Martin McGuinness to resign and collapse the structures. Now, in one way, you would hardly notice that we don't have a government. Now, that's strange to say, but the schools still run, the potholes are fixed in the roads, the bridges are repaired, the health service functions, the transport works. But we have a sort of death by a thousand cuts, you know, as decisions aren't made, so big projects can't be started. So there's a care and maintenance budget, but not a renewal or a refreshing or new plans. And that is less visible, but it is having serious impact on those basic public services. So the longer it goes on, the more difficult it is for people on the streets to access the services. And it means that the private sector aren't investing, and there's very little new development. So it's not a good situation, and right. We're hoping that the resolution of the Brexit debate, I mean, it won't solve everything overnight, but at least it will give a direction of travel. At least it could cause a coming together again to govern this place in the north, whilst looking south on the island economy and looking east in terms of the trade between these two islands. So Brexit holds the key to a lot of that.
Now, okay, so we go back to 1988, the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. In that, you had, of course, you had Britain, you had the Republic of Ireland, and then you had the subject of and the goal of getting an assembly up and running in Northern Ireland. Now, there are those who would say that, you know, now with Brexit, that's the UK, you know, choosing to and not backing down on getting out of the European Union, that that this, you know, that these negotiations have more to do with Britain, Northern Ireland, and how can we explain the massive influence that Southern Ireland has so much of a say in this, and what's acceptable, what's not, and is that welcome in Northern Ireland? Is it welcome in Britain and with the European Union, which, as you point out, this is not just, this is, you know, European Union representing 22 countries. How does that mix come in? Who's holding the trump card or cards?
You're right. It is a remarkable situation, and there has been a significant shift. And some people are treating that with relish, that for so long Ireland was seen as the colony, the junior partner, the one that split away and was on its own. It had a small economy. It was an island off an island and therefore couldn't properly relate to the world. And now all of that has changed. And the 27 countries of the EU have effectively given Ireland their negotiating rights. Remarkable. You know, the Chancellor of Germany, Angela Merkel, President of France, Emmanuel Macron, have said, Taoiseach, you tell us what to do because your island and your border and your peace process are the most important thing for us as the European family, and we will treat you with solidarity. Now, that is remarkable, and that means that meeting, I think we'll look back on that meeting on Thursday outside Liverpool between Taoiseach Varadkar and Prime Minister Johnson as a real breakthrough where they stood as equals. You could say that Varadkar was more powerful because he had 500 million votes in his pocket as against Johnson's 60 million. And what we think happened is that Johnson gave concessions, and they are all about the Irish border. And that, again, is a delicious irony that the British state is being held to account over Ireland rather than the other way around, and that Ireland North and South has a lot of the key cards to this. So if you want to keep a free border, you either need to stay in the European Union. The British don't want that because of the referendum result. Yes. You either have to stay in the customs union and the single market under a Norway or a Swiss arrangement. The British Conservatives don't like that. Or you've got to put a border in the sea between the two islands, and the Unionists in the northern part obviously don't like that because that breaks their union with Britain. Or you've got to have a special arrangement for Northern Ireland, which can be treated as being in the single market of Ireland and therefore of Europe. And that's what they're now negotiating on. And that would be a remarkable outcome, which could come through next week. I mean, it's a slim chance,
right,
but there's a real energy around that now that that could come through on Tuesday in Luxembourg and then be presented to the European Council that the deal is done because Johnson has had to back down. And it's interesting. I mean, the DUP position is clearly important because they hold those magic 10 votes in Westminster, and they support the Conservative government, but they might feel obliged to withdraw their support, and that would then be interesting as to whether the rest of the British establishment backed them or said, sorry, a British exit as opposed to a UK exit will be more important, and we respect the open trade and the open movement of people across this island back and forwards as we've had for the last two decades. So there are big decisions going to be made in the next week, and they will be interesting to see where the power lies and what the benefits are for the people on the street.
How, Quentin Oliver, I want to ask you, where was the crack in the egg? You had you know, Boris Johnson, Prime Minister, who actually bragged and says it's because you know, I want to get this thing over with, and we're going to, you know, to get out, and we're going to do this on, you know, on Halloween. What? When did the writing start to show on the wall, and that, you know, that this Cromwellian, you know, prime minister, you know, that he must have had either advisors or it dawned on him that his own political future and perhaps his legacy might have indeed focused attention on him, not so much the you know, the European Union. The blame game was starting to shift in his direction. But what would you say, and when was that point, and what changed that the Boris Johnson, this man, this ruler, was now forced, or was it forced, or did he say, I'm fed up with this, or did he feel that more time was needed? What was it? What was it about that?
Okay, I'm going to lay my cards on the table, and you can hold this over me in the future months, because I think what happened was the same thing happened simultaneously in London and Dublin about a month ago, and that was the assessment that a no-deal Brexit would be cataclysmic, not just for the British state, but also for the Irish state. And I think that the Taoiseach was shocked when the report came to Cabinet in Dublin, you know, saying if there was a no-deal Brexit, the Irish economy would plummet, jobs would be lost, and I think the really shocking thing was people would die. People would die through lack of medicine. People would die through their inability to get access to services. People would die from the blockages of goods and food and basic foodstuffs not getting in and out of their countries. And that applied across these islands. And I think that realization began to change things, where Johnson shifted from do or die, we will leave regardless, into, okay, I need to make some concessions. And that's what we believe he did in Liverpool on Thursday, that the Taoiseach was able to say, aha, now we have a window of opportunity. If you are prepared to look at a free border on this island and more controls in the sea between the two islands, which had hitherto been anathema, and if Johnson has conceded that, that will be unpalatable to unionism in the north because it emphasizes a breach of the UK union and the same rules. But it's a very practical solution, because when I drive, as you know, we can drive over to Scotland on the boat.
Clinton, Oliver, again.
Please enter the number you wish to call.
There you are. All right. We obviously we've lost the connection there with Quentin Oliver, but suffice it to say that he has spelled it out for us. My last question would have been, okay, in the scale from 1 to 10, what are the chances of a Brexit deal that includes the best possible solution for Northern Ireland? Anyway, Quentin Oliver, again, perhaps the most reliable conflict resolution analyst in you know, in definitely in Ireland, and again throughout the world, you know. Now, Quentin Oliver, a global conflict resolution and referendum specialist.